From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM Split Show tonight. Later on, the greatest storyteller ever born, Lionel Fanthorpe, joins us with stories that will just make you shake. Here's what's happening. A coronal mass ejection propelling from the sun toward planet Earth. An X5 class solar flare expected to reach our planet on March 8th. That's tomorrow. Analysts at the Goddard Space Weather Lab prepared the CME's forecast track, and they say the impact could spark a strong to severe geomagnetic storm. And what does that mean? It could affect the GPS systems, the power grid, just about everything. On top of all that, a smaller CME hit the planet today. Now, last night, Mitch Batras was on with us, earthchangesmedia.com. As soon as he got off the air, he was calling us right back because he said, you know what? The X5 class flare is on its way. Let's bring Mitch in again. Mitch, we've been talking about this for years, but here we are. This, they say, is the biggest in, what, 5 years?
That's right. And George, let me just take a second to renew my gratitude to your show. When we spoke last night and then when I called back with the breaking news, and then to see it internationally being covered in a very serious manner.
Yes.
Not only is it a large flare, it's an X-class flare, it's a 5.4. It is a direct hit. It will be a direct hit. I'm staking my reputation on this. I'm telling you right now that I expect the Aurora Borealis to drop down into longitudes of say, 46 degrees. So I'm saying perhaps even as low as Colorado. And I mention that to highlight the significance of this punch. Not only large, but centrally Earth-directed.
And the big question, Mitch, is who gets punched? Will it be on the United States side, North America? Will it be over on Asia? Who gets it?
Everybody. Here's a perfect example.
Because it's ongoing, isn't it?
Well, it's ongoing. Now, the two areas that will be most affected are always the North and South Pole because of its interaction with the Earth's core. However, it's these interconnected events that always occur. For example, Tom asked me just a few minutes ago, it sounds like somebody's going to die. And I said, no, Tom, that's in the movies. No one's going to die from from this event, not from a charged particle. However, what it does occur is volcanoes will erupt, or earthquakes will occur, or there'll be hurricanes.
But what if somebody's on a pacemaker, Mitch?
As of today, I've not seen any evidence that anybody has died from that type of shortage. Now, if a large enough event was to occur, now we're talking about in cycle 23, the November 4th event of 2003, that was an X45. Now, that happened to be just rotated around the eastern limb of the sun. If that was in the position of this one, this X5.4, which is dead center, what's called the solar meridian, then maybe something like that could happen. Then people may be in danger from a direct hit directly to charged particles.
So this is big, but it's not big enough in your mind to really hurt us that much.
Yeah, people don't need to be panicking about, oh, here comes, the sun is going to kill me. No. But what will happen is that, of course, the power grids are very vulnerable. This could be the one, George. I'm not saying it is. I'm saying it has all the makeup. Matter of fact, the international news reports of highly credible news sources are pretty edgy about this. Not only that, we've got a volcano in Russia that's gone to code red in the last 10 hours.
That's weird.
Tropical storm Irina has killed 73 people as of the last 12 hours. Now, that's coming from the events. Remember, George, I was telling you that 7 M-class flares have occurred. Another 8 CMEs have occurred in the last 7 days.
This is like a Hollywood movie, Mitch.
Well, I'm glad you said it that way because now it reminds me to reel it in a bit, George. I want to be cautious in how excited I get. I get excited because it's my research.
It's your life.
It's my life, and when I see the dots connecting, I can get really excited. And sometimes I become insensitive. And people on the other end listening to the radio right now might be kind of saying, oh, my gosh. So let me back up a bit and say, folks, I don't expect anybody to die as a direct causal effect of charged particles. I'm putting my reputation on the line saying we will see earth-changing events occurring, and that means earthquakes, volcanoes, tornadoes, hurricanes.
Will we see sporadic power outages?
That's the one, George. I can't say for sure, but this has everything it would take to knock out a power grid. That I can say. Watch for the aurora borealis to dip way down in the longitudes. I mean, down to maybe Colorado. That tells you a lot.
It sure does. Mitch, thanks so much. We'll continue to monitor this situation. Again, a coronal mass ejection, X5 headed this way. If that's not enough, a possible catastrophe in the making. Next year, asteroid 2012 DA14 has a slight chance of hitting planet Earth. In a moment, Dan Durda, planetary scientist, joins us. We'll talk about that. U.S. regulators warning the maker of inhalable caffeine product, it's called AeroShot Pure Energy, over false and misleading labeling and for statements about using the product with alcohol. They say that it could be unsafe. Be very careful there. Toyota Motors recalling 680,000 vehicles in the United States in two separate recalls. One recall involving airbags in pickups. The other is for faulty brake lights in sedans and crossovers. The larger of the two recalls involve 500,000 2005 to 2009 Toyota Tacoma trucks. So be careful or bring it into the dealer. Iran is not open about its nuclear program, but it should be, according to the head of the UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency. Let's turn to Ryan Morrow. He's the founder of WorldThreats.com. Ryan, we talked last time about the possibility of any kind of armed conflicts with Iran. So far, nothing, but it's still, I think, on the table somewhere. What are your sources telling you?
Well, I think it's very obvious that the U.S. is trying to convince Israel not to launch a military strike. The current studies indicate that Iran could have the fuel for a nuclear weapon by September, but then after that, you still have to construct the bomb and construct a missile. So the question is, where is Israel's red line? Now, the big news today is that the Saudi ambassador to Bangladesh ended up dead. He was murdered. Uh-oh. And everyone suspects that that was Iran. And so this fulfills what I've been talking about, including on your show for quite some time, that we are seeing a huge proxy war escalate between the Sunni Islamists and the Shiite Islamists between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
And will this get out of hand?
Very easily. It already is getting out of hand. If you look at what's happening in Syria, for example, the Iranian regime is just pouring in aid to help Bashar Assad kill his own people. And then the U.S. Is staying mostly out of that conflict. But then you have the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar supporting elements in Syria against the regime. And that means that they're going to be promoting Islamists like the Muslim Brotherhood.
Is the reason why we're not involved in Syria right now, Ryan, under these atrocities, because there's nothing they're forced to take?
I don't believe so, because I do believe that there is a lot that we could gain from toppling Bashar Assad, because he is such a close ally of Iran. And I do think that the prospects for democracy and a better future for Syria are there. But I think it's political willpower. And you have to remember, Syria has what some say is the largest chemical weapons arsenal on Earth. So what happens to that as the regime falls? It's a very scary scenario.
And whose hands does it all fall into, right?
Exactly.
All right. Ryan Murrell's website, worldthreats.com. Think about all the personal information you keep on your cell phones. Something to consider now. After the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit Court ruled it is now legal for police to search cell phones without a warrant. This decision stems from an Indiana case where police arrested a man for dealing drugs and the officer grabbed the phone without a warrant. The court says it'd probably go all the way up to the Supreme Court eventually. But right now, that it's legal for police to search cell phones without a warrant. Apple unveiling a new iPad with high definition. It's 2,048 by 1,536 pixels. That's pretty great resolution. And, of course, it's going to cost a little bit more than the earlier iPads. A pair of 73-year-old twin sisters and former television stars had been dead for at least several weeks before police found them in their California home after they died to what investigators believe were natural causes, but just a short time between one another. One died, the other died. Former 1950s entertainers Patricia and Joan Miller were found in separate rooms of their shared South Lake Tahoe home last month. Foul play ruled out. All right, let's talk about the asteroid. It's called 2012 DA14. It was just found. Dan Durda joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Split show for you tonight. Dan Durda with us for a couple hours. We'll take calls next hour as we talk about asteroids. He, of course, is a planetary scientist and a darn good one, and we turn to him for all kinds of stories. Matter of fact, he was my very first Coast to Coast interview when I filled in for Ian Punnett back on April 28th, 2001. Here he is, Dan Durda. Can you believe we've been going at it this long, Daniel?
It's been a lot of fun, George. Great sure to talk has. To you.
Finally, we get an asteroid that comes close.
Pretty darn close. Yeah, this one's going to be a lot of fun. I'll start from the beginning and just make sure everyone's aware that we know it's not going to hit next year. We know that already for a fact. But it's going to be a darn close shave. It's going to be pretty fun.
Can anything tip the scales to make it hit the planet?
Not at this point for that particular impact, or for that particular impact, for that particular close approach. We know the orbit well enough from the few observations we've had now to project that out pretty good. It's going to, you know, it's a close shave. There's no doubt. It's about 17,000 miles out. That's, you know, we're getting into the sort of geosync satellite sort of,
that's right,
sort of distance. So that's pretty amazing.
Why wouldn't the gravitational pull of the planet pull this in? Is it just going by too fast or what?
Well, in a sense it is. It's the very close approach itself that's already set up by Earth's gravitational pull as it flies past the planet. It does make that little bit of a, you know, it falls in toward the planet and then gets slowed down as it recedes back out again. So it's absolutely definitely being affected by the Earth's gravitational field. But that's taken care of in the whole calculation of where that orbit's going. It's the subsequent passes after that, because of that close approach, that we've got some fuzz on. And, you know, there, when you look out into the future, like, for instance, very specifically, the next very close approach in the year 2020 for that particular asteroid, it's so close at the moment that it's, you know, the uncertainty in the approach distance for 2020 is almost indistinguishable from an impact at this point. So that's, you know, it's not to say it's going to impact. I'm just saying that's how, as you project into the future, how fuzzy the orbits get, because we just don't have enough constraining information yet.
Now, this object was spotted by Spanish stargazers just a month ago.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
everything that we've allotted so far for tracking asteroids, mm-hmm. why do we have Spanish stargazers finding this instead of us?
Yeah, well, this is a great, actually, I'm glad you asked that, because this is kind of fun. In fact, in a little minor way, I've got a little bit of involvement in that particular situation. It's kind of a fun one, actually. So to set that up to begin with, as you intimated, yes, there are several significant asteroid search programs that are going on right now. They're funded primarily by NASA. In fact, they're funded entirely by NASA, the big surveys. These are the ones here in the United States, Catalina Sky Survey, the LONEO Survey, those big professional ones that are doing the, searching all the sky all the time, finding the vast majority of the asteroids that are passing close to us. And they're doing a darn good job. That said, there are places still for amateur astronomers to contribute in a very significant way to our understanding of these particular objects, primarily when it comes to the follow-up observations. These surveys are intended to discover the objects and track their positions for us, but they're not intended necessarily to go and do the actual physical observations to tell us more about the properties of the objects that are being discovered. And so one way to fill it in is with the really magnificent efforts of amateur astronomers who actually, ironically enough, actually have sometimes better equipment and more time to do the observation than the professionals.
Well, thank God for them, huh?
Absolutely. And in this case, it's been a lot of fun because we actually, this is a program that was funded by the Planetary Society based in Pasadena, California. They have a program, the Gene Shoemaker NEO program, which I'm actually the coordinator for. And it turns out that last year, one of the people that we funded out of that program was Jamie Noman and his colleagues in Spain. And they were the ones who actually discovered this object after its close approach last month.
Daniel, is there any possibility that this asteroid, which is going to get to around 17,000 miles of the planet, could break up and pieces of it? Now, it's only 150 feet in diameter, but still, can it break up and have pieces hit the planet?
There's, you know, that's still pretty far out for that kind of a, that strength of force, but you're getting exactly the right idea that with these kinds of close approaches, especially objects in this sort of size range, which, you know, we think might be, what we call rubble piles, the assembled, you know, gravitationally assembled bits and pieces and fragments from previous breakups of these little guys. There's a, you know, some of these objects, when they come close, the tidal forces of the Earth actually can you know, rearrange, cause landslides on these things as they fly by. And so there's a fair chance that this guy's going to feel some gravitational tugging and pulling. Probably not enough to actually pull it apart, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if you could, you know, imagine yourself riding along on the surfaces of this thing that you might well see some little asteroid quakes, if you will, and maybe some little minor landslides and things like that. With gravity this small and such a tiny object, you get one little landslide, it's not out of the question you might get some little bits of gravel and rubble sort of in temporary orbits around the thing.
Could it hit a satellite?
In terms of distance passing by, I think that's certainly a possibility. I have to tell you, I don't know exactly what the, you know, sort of where it's passing in the latitude space out there in space past the Earth. So I don't know, you know, the geosynchronous satellites that are at those sorts of distances are out there in pretty much an equatorial belt around the Earth. Not necessarily, some are at higher inclinations, but most of them are sort of around the equator. And if this thing is passing through that distance but at a higher or lower latitude, then that risk drops down quite a bit. But it's certainly at that sort of close distance, there's always that possibility.
What does this tell you, Daniel, about just the possibility of an asteroid one day hitting the planet, not a matter of if, but when? It could happen and come out just at any time, couldn't it?
That in this size range, that's definitely true. We by no means have we discovered even most of the objects in this size range that are passing through through near Earth space. So this is one of these objects that, there's about a 50-50 chance. And this one actually, I think, was discovered after its closest approach on February 16th. So, you know, if it had made a much closer approach this time, and, you know, this illustrates this is one of these situations where we could have had a little, you know, one of these sonic boom sort of impacts up in the upper atmosphere without us knowing about it beforehand.
Where will it go once it passes us by?
Right now, that's kind of the uncertainty for next year. Is we don't know exactly. I mean, we know roughly, roughly enough to be able to project its path out, you know, decades into the future, but not well enough to predict where it's going to end up those decades in the future.
Do they leave the solar system at all?
Some do, not because of terrestrial encounters like this. Our gravity isn't really powerful enough to tug them and throw them out of the solar system, but Jupiter's certainly is. Jupiter's gravity is, and many near-Earth asteroids suffer a fate that, because many of these objects will pass deep enough into the asteroid belt during their orbits that they can be perturbed by Jupiter, and Jupiter's gravity can then change their orbits enough to either fling them into the sun. Many near-Earth asteroids die an ultimate death by actually doing a swan dive right into the sun. And that's caused ultimately by perturbations due to Jupiter.
Would you be more concerned about Apophis in 2036 than this one next year?
Certainly from a size perspective, this is a tiny object compared to Apophis. And actually, quite frankly, there's another extremely interesting object that's on our quote-unquote radar screens, if not literally. This is an object that was discovered last year called 2011 AG5, and that's worth the whole next half hour discussing if you want to do that.
Okay,
that's a fun one.
Let's do that. We'll talk about that. I want to ask you a couple scenarios about this 150-footer that's coming by in February, and we'll see what your thoughts are on that as well. Our special guest for the next 2 hours, planetary scientist Daniel Derda. We'll also talk with him about planets, new discoveries, Are any out there harboring life just like us? I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM, and you can always email me at coasttocoastam.com. Here we go with planetary scientist Daniel Derna. Dan, if this 150-footer, if it happens to hit in the ocean, I know you said the likelihood of it hitting pretty non-existent, but if it did hit in the ocean, 150-footer, would that create a tsunami?
Yeah, we think so. We've kind of discovered over the recent years that for objects that at that scale, the scale of the tsunami might not be as great as was once feared, but it would certainly not be good. This is probably something of the scale of the tsunami that just devastated Southeast Asia in 2004, December 2004.
Sure.
It was what, hundreds of thousands of people.
300,000, yeah.
Right. So it's, I mean, that's nothing to take lightly. And I think object, an impact of an object of this scale we're talking about a tsunami in that size range.
If it hit on land, if it hit a city, what kind of damage would it have?
Yeah, we're talking, I think the estimates I've seen are something on the order of a megaton or a couple megatons of TNT equivalent for an impact of that scale. Of course, there's none of the radiation that you would get from a nuclear weapon of that,
right,
of that scale, but certainly all of the blast and the heat energy of the flash of the impact. So that would be, definitely not something you want to have happen over your city. And this is, we're talking an object here that's, in scope and scale similar to the Tunguska impact in Siberia in 1908. That was a weak, rocky object that about this same sort of scale, several tens of meters across.
That blew up in the atmosphere, right?
Yeah, it made it down. You have to think of this thing flying through the vacuum of space and, kind of effectively doing a belly flop into the dense lower atmosphere of the Earth. Those hurt if you've ever done a deep belly flop. if you're a weak rock coming in from space, it hurts pretty bad, too, because you end up pancaking in the lower atmosphere at these sort of, supersonic speeds, basically. It's a pretty violent event for that poor little rock. And the Tunguska object, we think from the barometric records and the other physical evidence around the area, it looks to have broken up at about, sort of up there at about 8 kilometers up or so before it finally just couldn't take it anymore.
Okay, but it could take out 150-foot rock, could take out a city, couldn't it?
Definitely. This is at a scale of size where that rock might not necessarily make it to the surface intact, but it would certainly, in the process of burrowing itself down, through the lower atmosphere toward the surface, all of the momentum of that object is transmitted down through the atmosphere still, and that can still cause a lot of devastation on the ground. This is, it's effectively like a nuclear weapon airburst, many of these weapons are designed to not burst at the surface or below the surface, but above the surface to maximize the atmospheric blast at the surface, and that's by in a sense by accident what happens with many of these smaller rocky objects, natural objects from space. They tend to mimic a nuclear air blast.
In your opinion, what is the latest of a notification of impact? Would it be an hour, a day, a month? How soon would we know? At what point would we know? Okay, we're going to get hit.
If for an object in general or for this particular, I mean, for an object in general, the notification might be the blast in the sky.
Really?
Absolutely.
So we might not have time to evacuate.
Especially for some of these objects that are on objects that spend, a significant enough portion of their time interior to Earth's orbit, there's a significant chance that they can actually make their approach to the Earth from the sort of the daytime side of the Earth. And so for the several days before impact, especially if it's one of these small guys that we only usually will spot in the several days that they spend near the Earth, if that first time that it's passing near in centuries happens to be coming from the day side of the Earth, we'd never know it was coming in the first place. And the first warning is the blast itself.
Now, what would happen politically if something like this hit over the United States or Russia or China? The first thought would be somebody just launched on us.
I think we're educating slowly over time that these can be, natural events. But I agree. I think there is certainly a risk, especially during a time of otherwise heightened tension in the proper quote-unquote place in the world, I think the initial reaction could be to think that it was a terrorist event or a purposeful attack,
and absolutely
that could unleash other very bad consequences.
Oh my gosh! Okay.
Well, the one benefit we do have is that okay, that might be the most immediate initial reaction, but the United States does have a constellation of defense early warning satellites that are specifically watching the atmosphere for these sorts of flashes. Those data for several years were sort of not in real time, but on a sort of a monthly basis released to scientists working in this field to kind of give us some basic data on how often these sorts of flashes happen. And those flashes can be, the natural impacts can be distinguished from the nuclear detonations pretty easily from the specific signatures that go on there. And the Department of Defense would release some of those data to people in my community, the impact community, to provide some basic data. And so we kind of have a sense of how often those kinds of things happen, and that gives us a sense, obviously, of how well those sorts of objects or those sorts of events are being monitored by the Department of Defense. And so even though the initial reaction might be, ugh, something bad just happened, I think very quickly an understanding of the reality of what that impact would filter through the defense community, at least here in the United States, pretty quickly.
If one hit in the ocean right now, how long would it take for us to know about it and for us to be able to report it on the program, for example?
So what I just told you about the Department of Defense reporting, that has since, I think in the last couple years now, has been in a sense turned off in terms of the reporting to the science community. The data are still obviously being taken by DOD, but they're not reporting that to us anymore. And so we wouldn't get that information flow down probably unless, for some reason it was big enough and caused other events that, DOD might want to release it. But so if it happened out in the middle, quote-unquote, middle of nowhere, middle of the Pacific someplace, short of having that sort of satellite detection, I think, unless there was a ship nearby or something like that that might report a flash through radio off and things like that, the next warning might be the actual, the tsunami warning system that's set up in the Pacific.
Good point.
So, that might be some solace there, at least. I think at this point, I don't know that there's a analogous tsunami warning network in the Atlantic or in other ocean basins. So,
probably end up being a Twitter or Facebook thing.
It very well might for a smaller scale thing like that. If it was. Literally one of these, literally out of the blue sort of impacts, that might well be the first notice we have.
2011 AG5, what's that?
Oh, that's a very interesting object. In some ways, because, we know the DA-14 thing is not going to hit next year, in some ways this AG5 story is a lot more interesting. This is a larger object, something like 140 meters across.
Meters.
We're talking football stadium sort of size, or
even
or,
yeah, that's
or,
right.
I guess cricket stadium or something like that if you're in other parts of the world. But that's pretty big. So that's even bigger yet. And that does get down into the size range where this thing wouldn't break up we wouldn't break up completely in the atmosphere, and it would probably make it to the surface intact and not just cause an air burst, but an actual crater in the ground sort of a thing. Well, anyway, so this object was discovered back a little over a year ago, last January 8th. Nothing all that, crazy about it, other than the fact that it's going to make a near approach. I wouldn't say a very close approach, but a near approach to the Earth in what sounds like a long-off time, in February of the year 2023. But the interesting thing about that close approach is it involves the potential for one of these keyhole passages that we've talked about in the past.
Uh-huh.
This is one of these thread-the-needle sort of situations,
mm-hmm,
where if the object passes through just the right sort of spot in space, its orbit will be bent in just the right way to return on a resonant return trajectory to impact the Earth in a future year. And in this particular case, the passage we're watching for is this keyhole passage that would set up a potential impact in the year 2040.
February
5th of 2040. And right now, as it stands, given everything we know about the object, which is not a lot, but we know its trajectory at this point, there's about a 1 in 625 chance that it might thread that needle and pass through that keyhole.
That's pretty close.
That's, you know, if you're a poker player, that's, you know, people tell you never take that bet because there's 624 chances out of 625
that's right.
that the odds of this impact are going to go to zero. But this is not a 1 in a million thing or a 1 in 10,000 or something. This is 1 in 625 as it stands right now. That's, and so that in itself maybe is not all that big a deal from the, you know, from the sort of the pure statistics point of view. Because again, you know, more than likely future observations are going to give us enough information to, you know, just eliminate that possibility mm-hmm. altogether.
Well, you know, Dan, we've been talking about getting hit by X flares, and here we are tomorrow.
Yeah.
We're going to get hit by one. X5, thank God it's not an X45, but it's going to happen. And I think this is going to happen.
Where you're going with this is the asteroid impact scenario is going to happen. Someday.
Absolutely.
And absolutely. And this is, and so again, this is another one of these teaching moments. Back in 2004, Apophis gave us presented to us one of these learning moments about keyholes. That was the sort of the first object that really drove home to the greater story of the whole point of these keyhole things is that, you know, a close approach now can set up a future impact in the future that we got to really watch for. And it taught us about, oh, wait a minute now. So if that's the case, you have to, if you know you're going to go through a keyhole or there's a significant passage or odds of passing through that keyhole, that's the event that you want to do the deflection for, not wait for the subsequent impact setup. You want to deflect to avoid the keyhole.
That's right.
Because that's a much that's easier right. job to accomplish. That was the learning example from Apophis. 2011, AG5 is presenting us with a whole new scenario now because of the timing of things. We don't know very much about its orbit yet. We won't get more information for about a good another 18 months, not until, like, you know, yeah, about 18 months from now. And the bad thing is that, you know, if with odds, quote unquote, as high as this 1 in 625, if we really do have to avoid a keyhole passage in 2023, that's not that long from now from a mission planning point of view. And some folks are kind of a little thinking that, you know, not that we necessarily need to take any action yet, but, you know, maybe even before we wait this next 18 months until there's, you know, more information on where this object is going to go, maybe during this time we ought to be kind of maybe thinking about putting out some studies for what a deflection mission might look like.
That's
not to actually do, you know, start setting up a mission, but just
planet.
To ask the questions about what that mission yeah. would look like.
If an asteroid were to hit the planet, where's the best place for us for it to hit?
Oh, goodness. Let's see. Well, again, it's partially dependent on size. If it's a small enough object, I would say because of what we've learned recently about the fact that the tsunamis can be a little, you know, not as devastating as we thought, because a lot of the energy is absorbed in the continental shelf before it actually gets to the coast itself. I'd say for a small impact, you know, middle of the Pacific or, you know, down off the coast of Antarctica or something would probably be one of the best bets for something like that because or, you know, maybe over some very remote desert area
right.
where the population density is effectively zero.
If it's big,
there's almost no good place.
There's no good place.
Yeah, because, you know, if you get to a certain size, something like, you know, half a kilometer across or so, you know, a quarter of a mile or a third of a mile or bigger, it doesn't matter where it hits. There's enough ozone destroying chlorine and bromine just in the normal natural asteroidal composition of the rock out there. There's enough ozone destroying chlorine and bromine to kind of do some pretty significant damage to the atmosphere, no matter where it hits.
When you were a kid, did you ever skip rocks across the top
oh,
of
yeah,
a rock?
All the time.
And it, you know, goes ding,
yep.
ding, ding, and off
yep.
it goes.
Yep.
Depending on the angle then of an asteroid, could it hit the ocean and skip off like a rock and go flying somewhere else?
By the time an object like that has gotten down deep enough into the Earth's atmosphere to be, you know, getting into an ocean impact, you wouldn't see an asteroid because of the speeds involved now. Because we're
talking
about the angle's
too steep.
Well, it's not even the angle at this point. It's the speeds we're talking about are you know, what we would call hypervelocity. The ocean itself would react in a very much different way than the rocks that we have skipped off of lakes in our childhood or in our adulthood, because I still like to do that. There is an effect like this where we've even witnessed events like this. In fact, there's a old home movie camera footage of a small rocky object doing exactly this, skipping off the atmosphere, not off the ocean, but off the atmosphere over the Tetons back in, I think, 1972. This is an object comes in at just the right angle. It goes deep enough into the atmosphere, but then right back out again. And
planets.
We've actually witnessed that happen.
We're finding water worlds, Earth-like planets.
Oh, man.
All the time. It's got to be exciting for you.
This is the glory age of extrasolar planet discoveries. We are living in the magic time where we are discovering that our solar system is not unique and definitely not alone out there in the galaxy.
And we knew that, didn't we, before they discovered that.
Yeah, you know, this is one of those things you sort of know deep in your heart must be true.
That's
but,
right.
You know, you working in science, you can't rely on those sort of feelings. You got to go out and look for the evidence.
Yep,
we really expected this was going to be the case, and sure enough it is.
I mean, they projected, about a month ago, they said that there could be billions of Earth-like planets just in the Milky Way galaxy.
That's right. I think the hottest mission that NASA has got going right now is the Kepler mission.
Yes, I think so too.
A space-based telescope.
Finding planets left and right.
Pointing at a patch of the Milky Way, literally finding thousands and thousands and thousands, not just of planets, but of planetary systems out there in a little patch of the, and this is just in one patch of the sky. In the plane of our galaxy, out in a part of the summertime sky near the constellations Cygnus and Lyra.
Why do they hone in on that area?
Well, because you're looking in the plane of the galaxy, and so you're maximizing the number of stars you're looking toward in that particular direction of space. You're looking not necessarily toward the center of the galaxy, but toward a pretty dense region in the spiral arm that we're orbiting in, and so you're maximizing the number of stars in the field of view that you can look at one time.
That's exciting. And it's just a matter of time. You know, Daniel, as much as we guessed when we were kids about planets out there, I know there's life out there, too.
Yeah, that's exactly. I it's the same thing, right? You know in your heart it's true. It's just you got to find the evidence. But you know in your heart it's true.
And civilizations that could be millions and millions of years more advanced than us.
Absolutely.
That's exciting. Well, stay with us, Daniel. We're going to come back in a moment. We're going to take more phone calls with you. What's new with you these days?
Very interesting stuff. We just got back from a conference in Palo Alto, California. This is the Next Generation Suborbital Sciences Conference, and there are about 400 of us who are getting ready to fly in space in a couple years to do research on this next generation of vehicles that have been developed primarily for space tourism, but we're going to be hitching rides on these things to do research as well, so I'd love to talk about
that. That's exciting. You're going to do that, huh?
I've got a couple of tickets to space.
Super. You didn't have to pay $250,000 to go up there, did you?
No, not quite.
They are making money doing stuff like that.
Yeah, Virgin Galactic is the premier company at the moment that has signed up the most tickets so far, and they are just ticking near 500 people who have bought tickets to space on their suborbital vehicle.
Like at $200,000 a ticket or something.
Currently at $200,000 a ticket.
That's exactly.
That 500 number is kind of an interesting number. It's symbolically very important because over the entire history of the space program, from the very late 1950s to today, there have only been a total of about 500 people who have ever flown in space. And Virgin Galactic has already signed up, and in probably about their first year of operations, will fly more people in space in that first year or two than has currently flown in the entire history of the space.
That's exciting. Well, we're going to come back. We're going to take phone calls with the planetary scientist, Daniel Derda. Your calls next on Coast to Coast AM.